Breaking down the top NBA draft prospects across the globe, you're listening to the Prospect Podcast with Ethan Piotta and Alex Brown. And welcome into another edition of the Prospect Podcast. I'm Ethan Piotta, joined again today by Alex Brown, and also joined today by our first guest on the Prospect Podcast, Derek Murray, Director of Video Scouting at Babcock Hoops. Derek, how's it going today?
I'm doing great, man. I appreciate y'all having me on here. Always good to catch up with a couple friends and always talk basketball. So I'm glad to be here.
Definitely.
Absolutely. So, Derek, you know, when did you really first get into prospect evaluation and scouting, would you say? And was it always a passion of yours or something that you kind of acquired? And
yeah, so I'd say the first time I realized that, you know, building teams and kind of being in organizational leadership and stuff like that, first time I ever realized it was as a kid that I just became obsessed with fantasy sports and building rosters when I was like in elementary school. I was really, really, really young. And even back then I just got a kick out of it and didn't know why. You know, as I got older, I realized, wow, you can actually get paid to do this stuff in real life. So even when I went to school, like I had no idea what I wanted to quote be when I grew up. But that was always kind of in the back of my head. So kind of taking that drive and just kind of the inside love of that, I got moved to Oklahoma City in 2016 and quickly started building relationships around the league and realized, okay, this is what, you know, I'm good at, but how do I start trying to make this a career? So 2016 is kind of when I got started. And then in 2017, I started writing and scouting for Net Scouts and Eurobasket. So Carl Berman gave me a chance there and started covering a lot of Big 12 basketball just because I was, you know, an hour from Stillwater in Oklahoma State, about 40 minutes from Norman and OU. So kind of started that, just getting my feet wet. And then in 2019, started my own site, the Blueprint NBA, and then started scouting for John Chepkevich and Jake Kelfer with the Pro Basketball Combine. And that really helped me kind of refine my skill set a little bit because it wasn't just writing for myself. It was writing for other people and what they needed. And I kind of learned how different people want reports to be written. I think that's important not to write in only the way that you're comfortable when you're starting. You know, even if people Definitely. Like to read it, like mix up how you write it because, you know, if guys want to get into a front office one day, one GM may hate the way you write and the other one may love it. So you're going to have to adjust to what they want. And then from 2019 to 20, in the fall of 19, I met Matt Babcock of Babcock Hoops, and you know, was an agent for years, represented a lot of big NBA guys and has relationships all over the league and world. So I saw that he had posted a picture on Twitter one time when he was in Oklahoma City scouting RJ Hampton in a preseason game. So again, my personality, like, and anybody who wants to get in the business should be like this. Don't ever be afraid to meet somebody. You know, a lot of people will tell you to screw off, but sometimes all you need is the one to take the time and invest and believe in you. And that was Matt for me. I hit him up on Twitter. I was like, hey, I'm actually in the building. I'm working right now. Can I just come meet you for 10 minutes? He said, sure, man, like come over. So I was actually on crutches at the time from an injury. So I was in a suit and on crutches. I was like, damn, this guy's going to think I'm just a loser. I'm just going to hobble up to the media booth to him. So I went and talked to him for 20 minutes, just talking basketball. How'd you get here? How'd I get here? Kind of thing. Left. He gave me a card. I thought, you know, really nice guy. About 2 months later, he hits me up and, you know, really, really late at night and says, hey, I need a video guy. And you came to mind, like, are you in? And I don't remember exactly what that text said, but it was along the lines of, I don't need to hear anything else. The answer is yes. Like, I don't need any more details. I'm in. And now I manage and direct kind of all the video scouting for Babcock Hoops and get to interview players and stuff, do breakdowns on them. And honestly, it's been a blast. So now I consult for the draft and do a lot of Babcock Hoops stuff, and I absolutely love it. So that's kind of my path into the game.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And I know I definitely came from that same, like, fantasy team building background. I started that in elementary school as well. I get how that drive brings you there, but
and it was weird. Even as a kid, I remember my dad saying, you know, we just got home from church, man. It's Sunday. The games haven't started. What are you doing? I'm like, Dad, at that point, I'll never forget. I was looking for the USA Today for like the lineups in the morning. Cause as a kid, I mean, I wasn't allowed to have an email address at that point. So it was, hey, we're going to hand wrote in pen and pencil, like our teams, our rules, our scoring and everything. And it's kind of crazy when you find a kid who just really loves that. And as soon as I got to a point that I was old enough to realize you could actually get paid for it in real life, like that was it.
Yeah, that passion is pretty telling early on. I feel that completely. But I really enjoyed, 100%. You know, really enjoyed listening to your past in scouting. And mm-hmm. I'm really excited to see where you go in the future as well, because, you know, we all think, you know, here at, you know, at the Prospect Pod and, you know, with Advanced Pro Basketball and all my other, all the other places we work for, we all think you have a pretty bright future, especially in the league. So
yeah, well, really
looking forward
to
seeing where that, where you go with that. Yeah. So moving on, I'd like to ask you, what would you say is your biggest draft hit, and maybe what's your biggest miss as well?
This was kind of interesting, kind of find answers before this. I kind of find myself, I don't have some like super, super great hit to where I'm like, I'm smarter than everybody else. Like I don't have that. But one that I will hang my hat on, I really, really, really loved Gilgeous Alexander coming out of school. So when we traded for him and we brought him to Oklahoma City, like obviously it was a pretty trying and emotional time when you move George, you move Russell and all this stuff.
Right.
Man, part of me on the inside, I was like, y'all, we got SGA. I know you don't know who he is right now, but you have no idea how good this kid is. Because I had him as a top 6-7 guy in that class. So I was just thrilled with him. So I would consider him a hit. I think my reasoning for that is, you know, like Killian Hayes in this year's class, they're not by any means the same player, but it's evident from his time at Kentucky that he got better game by game, week by week. Like you look at him on day one, you look at him at the end of the season, it's like, this kid got better. And that is why I was really bought into him. So even though he went in the lottery, if you can call him a hit, that's probably what I would say, because I think he's already outperformed his draft slot and will continue to do so. So he, and then in that same class, I really liked Landry Shamet. I saw him a couple times because Wichita State came down out of the big and played some Big 12 teams. And for NetScouts at that point, I was covering those games. And I just really thought he was a valuable player. One of the reasons that I liked him, again, we'll get into this later. I like guys that play with character. And you can tell when you're in person who plays with and without character. He was in some real foul trouble at this game at Oklahoma State. And he got pulled off the floor, you know, coach is pissed at him, you know, sit your ass down kind of thing, and walks down the bench. And, you know, if I'm in a bad mood, I'll be honest, I'd probably sulk my head or maybe throw my towel or something like that. He slaps every hand on the bench and then daps up all the managers, the water boys, everybody, like GAs, managers, everybody. Was nice to and just nothing on his face that showed that he was frustrated. Like they'd just given up the lead. He was not in a good spot as far as the game. Like, so I would have been upset, and I watched him handle that really, really, really well as a leader. And I thought, okay, I like the character that I'm seeing right now. And the kid also shoots 45% from three. Like I'll take my chances on Landry Shamet.
Yeah. I was a big Landry Shamet fan as well. The appeal was definitely there. I think he was a top 20 guy for me going back, but I loved him at Wichita State.
Yeah. I think another, hit, if you want to call it, is I did not like Josh Jackson at all. So if you want to call that a hit,
that is a hit.
I was very anti Josh Jackson out of school. I really believed in the tools that Kevin Knox had, and while it is a little bit early on the two misses, I'll say like I saw 6'9" possibility of shooter, like to handle the ball. I was like, man, I'm kind of in on Kevin Knox. So still partially hoping he turns it around. A lot of Knicks fans out there, I know they're torn between do we move him in a package or do we hang on to him. So him, and then I'm also still holding all of my Mo Bamba stock.
Yes.
I was all in. I saw him come through the Big 12 a bunch of times. Like, I know he had a rough go. Bigs also take longer to develop into NBA presence and NBA level than any other position. So I'm still holding on to that one. Although, if you wanted to count it right now, as of today – in that class, I guess you can call them this.
Yeah, the thing about those two players is, you know, we all knew they were projects coming into that draft class. And, you know, the thing with Knox, he was one of the younger guys in that class. And mm-hmm. I think it was like, if he's an 8-year pro, he'll be, you know, at 27 or something. Or,
right.
right. 9-year pro, he'll be 27. So they have a ton of time to develop. And I really like the, you know, Bamba's intangibles. I was always a huge fan of, you know, mm-hmm. just super intelligent guy. And, you know, with his strong work ethic. And I was like, you know, in time, he could really end up being an impactful player. And, you know, I think he's beginning to maybe start to turn the corner there. You know, I'm not an expert mm-hmm. on the Magic. I don't really get to watch them a ton, but, you know, I'm still holding my stock there too. So I think it's a little early to call him a miss, you know, but definitely mm-hmm. not as impactful as, you know, some of the other guys early on.
Right. And I know a lot of the Pure Sweat trainers, you know, Drew Hanlon and those guys do a great job. So I remember pre-draft, I saw Bamba working out with Drew and I just started drooling. It was that classic workout video, him one-on-one against a guy who's 6'2". And I was like, this kid's about to be an all-star tomorrow.
Yeah. Hey, Pure Sweat's legit, man. My head coach in high school was, I think he's the COO, whatever, but he works with Hamlin. And so we were always on the Pure Sweat programs. And I mean, I always like when I see prospects on them because they work. And it's hard not to salivate on it when you see a 7-foot guy like Bamba going on it.
Right. Hitting jump hooks with either hand.
It was beautiful.
I think Bamba's still got, like you guys said, he's still got some time though. And there's been a lot of reports of him gaining a lot of weight, gaining a lot of muscle mass over quarantine, which I arguably thought was the biggest thing for him, is the path to being an impactful rim protector, somebody that can hold his own.
Heavier.
Right, is that he had to put on weight, and it looks like he has. His shoulders definitely got bigger. And I think, that, you know, if he's able to continue to develop his outside shot and be an impactful rim protector, there's going to be a spot on an NBA roster for him for a long time. Mm-hmm. So it may be a miss right now, but I could definitely see that almost turning into a hit down the road if he continues on his track.
Yeah,
and he has some real outlier. I mean, you know, going back to the draft class, he had outlier measurements. He had some, I mean, even his athleticism for a guy with his length and size, he was kind of an outlier, along with his IQ. So, you know, there's still a lot of value there, honestly. You know, I think he's going to be a really good long-term player.
So kind of staying on to that, you know, topic of draft hits, draft misses, what's arguably, and there's obviously a disparity between like analytically driven, you know, learning processes and intangibly driven and other things, but what's the most important thing that you look for in a prospect when you're watching them for the very first time? Like what's a good first impression for you when you're watching a prospect for the first time on a basketball court?
Competitiveness and coachability. The things that you're not going to get watching video, the things that you've got to see in person or when you go and watch a practice. Like there are players that can have all the skill in the world, but if they're just flat out disinterested, disrespectful to coaches, their teammates, like it's crystal clear that they're not a good leader. You know, that kind of stuff turns me off pretty quickly. And if I'm going to overlook that, you better be elite in a couple skills. You know, they're going to make me pick you for my team. And I know that's partially just me being hard on people, but I think it's important because I think some people, you know, it's how good are they at this? I want them on my team. Well, that's very different than a general manager going to an owner and say, hey, I think this kid needs to be a part of our organization. And also when I make this selection, it's going to lock in you paying him $36 million over the next 4 years. So you have to have the intangibles there for me as a baseline. Like I'm looking at that first and then I will look at your basketball. Like there are players that their basketball or they have certain skills that are transcendent enough to where you look past it. Also, it's important to know that these are kids. They're 18, 19, 20 years old and they don't have to be mature adults yet. So there are times that even I need to check myself a little bit. It's like, hey, you know, don't expect the world of them, you know, quite yet. They still need to grow and mature in their own right off the floor. But coachability, you know, the way you kind of take coaching on the court and in practice and your competitiveness, like you want to win more than anything else. And if you've got those two things, then I want you on my team.
Yeah, I definitely agree there. I'm a huge intangibles guy. I know you are too. We've had a lot of conversations about that. And it's definitely something we can get turned off to you know, we can over or undervalue guys based on it. And, you know, I've talked to a couple of scouts that have been, you know, okay, first thing is, can he play? You know, I know a lot of guys tend to overlook that initially, but, you know, for a guy I want in my locker room, I really want somebody that's going to, you know, help both on and off the court and in and out of games. You know, I just don't want somebody who's, you know, I need coachable guys. You know, those are the guys I want to root for.
Talk about it. We talk about it all the time. Like literally when we're the my favorite part of what I've done early on in the draft process, I'm pretty much new to this, but I'm always looking for guys. At least when I played, my thing was making winning plays. And if you're a winning player, like someone that makes winning plays on a basketball court, then you're probably going to be somebody that I'm looking to add to my NBA team or add to my NBA roster. That's always been my biggest thing, because at the end of the day, it's about wins and losses in sports and in basketball too. So I mean, I think that's kind of telling, is, you know, does the prospect care about winning at whatever level, what, you know, whatever team, whether that's AAU on to a lesser extent, obviously, but you know, high school basketball, college, whatever, G League, overseas, do they care about winning? Can they contribute to winning in the right ways? Right. That's always been the biggest thing for me, is, you know, early on, intangible wise, it's just guys who make winning plays.
Yeah. Find a kid who's on a bad team, but even on a bad team, season's over, they're not winning the conference, close game, they want the ball because they want to win that night. Even if it's a small win just that night, they still care. Like that is huge for me. Because it just shows, like you're saying, like you want to make winning plays no matter what the situation, and that will translate.
Definitely, yeah, I 100% agree with that. That's one thing that a couple of prospects frustrated me a lot with this year. And when you really, you know, at the end of the day, they have to be able to drive winning, even when you're losing. You can't be giving up, and you know, even if these games don't matter in the long run, you know, because it's a long season. And, you know, if you don't have the drive to compete every night, you know, where are the indicators that are going to say you're going to do that at the NBA level in a much longer season with, you know, much more volatility?
Yeah. There hasn't been a successful NBA player that doesn't care about winning. So, I mean, I'll put it at that. There's not somebody that is remembered because, you know, they're there for other things. But kind of, you know, moving on to a different topic, almost back on our draft hits and misses, but what is your favorite positional archetype to evaluate and why?
Yeah, so I love ball handling wings. I think just because of their versatility, there's so much to watch, especially 3-and-D guys. You know, I'm a huge fan of anybody that can impact on the defensive end. You know, it's really big to me. So someone who can play both ways, like those are the guys that I love watching, love evaluating. And yeah, that's far and away my favorite.
Someone also say the hardest archetype or kind of role to evaluate in a way too. We talked about it with wings and 3-and-D guys, because they have such a high variance on their, you know, potential outcomes, and certain things have to obviously go right for them to become impactful on a basketball court. But ball handling wings especially is an interesting one, because those are often guys that don't come along often, and it's always fun watching a 6'9 guy or 6'10 guy run your offense, run the pick and roll from the wing, from the top. So yeah, definitely interesting.
Yeah. And I think it's frustrating when guys get like lumped into one of those categories as well. Like there have been many guys in this class. Well, let's say a few people say, oh, he's 3-and-D. When honestly, there's probably only one legitimate 3-and-D guy in this whole class that I would give that to. And it's Fussell. So while other names are in there as, oh, he's a 3-and-D. It's like, can they be 3-and-D? Yes. They'll have to have some things go right. They'll have to develop. But I think the term 3-and-D, while I love that player, I think it gets thrown around like kind of too easily, and that can be frustrating.
Way too easy. Yeah, definitely. Because there's, I mean, you have to be, I think, a top tier wing to be able to play both sides of the ball effectively in the NBA. And there's a lot of guys that even in the NBA, I'll give you a prime example, Matisse Thybulle. Like he's one of the best defenders that I've seen early on in his career. You know, as a rookie, at least with the 76ers this year, but often offensively, his 3-point numbers dipped to a point where it was hard to play him for extensive minutes because he was a liability on that side, self-creation, knocking down open shots, whatever. So, I mean, you look at a guy like Matisse too, he's shooting 35%, something like that. I mean, that's not horrible, but the fact that, you know, he's struggling at the NBA level, what makes you think that guys who are shooting 29, 28, you know, 30%, from three are instantly going to be these, you know, 3-and-D contributors at the next level. It's just, it's something that I've often thought about recently, and it takes time for, you know, both those styles of play to come together and form a successful 3-and-D player.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is so difficult for wings to evaluate, kind of like what Derek said, there's just so much going on there and so much that you know, you have to pay attention to. And, you know, it's not like evaluating bigs where you just have to say, okay, can they protect the rim? Can they, you know, can they rim run or, you know, just stretch the floor a little bit? You know, there's so much versatility that needs to be evaluated that, that's what makes wings the most difficult for me, but also, you know, one of the more fun ones to evaluate.
So keeping all this in mind, ultimately, I mean, we kind of touched on it before, but ultimately, Derek, like, where do you ultimately hope that the draft work that you do takes you?
Yeah, so I used to have one goal and one goal only, and that was get into an NBA front office, lead an NBA front office. And ultimately, you know, that vision is still there. Love to be a general manager. I know what all that entails, and it is so much more than basketball. Like, I think it's funny when you talk to GMs, you're like, you know, do you love being a GM? There's some who they're like, man, you know, you deal with so many things off the court that it to an extent becomes, you know, a lot to handle. And assistant GMs, quite frankly, probably have the greatest job in the world. You know, they don't have to deal with a lot of the other stuff that the GM might have to. They're just working the basketball. So you know, even people I think who kind of work up to assistant GM and don't ever get that, you know, GM job, I think that they have a sweet setup. So maybe that happens one day. But this ride has taught me that, you know, the world of evaluation in basketball, while it appears very, very, very small on the inside, like once you get in at all, there's so many paths and there's so many possibilities. So quite frankly, anything that makes the game my full-time job, like I would consider myself the luckiest guy ever. So it's definitely like the goal is more broad than it has been in the past. And I think that just comes from kind of my eyes being open to learn what all is out there. So tunnel vision, I definitely had it when I was younger, you know, even as a kid into the beginning of this process. But my advice to somebody would just be like, hey, you know, basketball is a big world and wherever you can get in, you know, if basketball is how you get your paycheck, then like you're a lucky person. So we'll just kind of see what happens.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't have put it better. You know, there's a lot of international opportunities coming up now. Basketball is getting better around the world, which means, you know, there's going to be more money about everywhere. You know, there's just so many new ways you can provide value. And I think you should, you know, if you can get in anywhere, you know, that's really the goal. That's the dream. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I definitely admire you for, you know, sticking with that and, you know, staying versatile. it'll be interesting to see where everybody ends up.
Yeah.
100%. If you're working, you said it right. Like you said it exactly how I think. If you're working around basketball, like the game that I assume we all have a passion for and want to be around, like you're winning. Like that's the bottom line. Like you're doing what you want to do. And so that's ultimately what I hope too, is that I'm just in some capacity making this my full-time thing. Because it, you know, it could be one of the most enjoyable jobs in the world if you're just, you know, doing your thing that you do now, except, you know, you're doing it for potentially an NBA franchise or somewhere overseas, anywhere. I mean, it's the possibilities are really starting to become, you know, a lot more variant now that basketball has taken off, like Alex said, around the world.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into some player breakdowns. If you haven't recently checked out Derek's report in video analysis on Jaden McDaniels, definitely do that. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about Jaden because he's rather polarizing among draft circles. And, you know, what value can he really provide? And, you know, what was your kind of overall outlook when looking at McDaniels?
Yeah, for sure. So Jaden was actually a kind of a fun one to write. You know, he's got one of the largest variances in this year's class, and the place he gets selected, I don't think it will depend like solely on his skill. I put in the article on two things, an organization's timeline and their strategy when it comes to risk aversion, because he is high risk, high reward, boom or bust, you know, any other cliche you want to put on that. Like that is him in this class. He's that guy. it's not every class you get a guy who's 6'9", you know, seven, forget what his wingspan is. And it's just, he can hit a pull-up three from anywhere. Got a beautiful hezzy crossover into a pull-up jumper. You can't defend it. It's too high of a release on a shot. It's beautiful. But his physical strength just is such a huge concern. Like, it hinders his ability to do anything on the floor. Gets bumped off his line with and without the ball. Offense, yeah. Defense, everything. Passing is a concern. 0.65 assist to turnover ratio. Not a great live dribble passer. Like, there are a lot of things that if a guy's going to hit an NBA floor for you regularly, that he that they have to be able to do, that right now he cannot. But he has some tools that, give you know, put in the right developmental situation, you could turn into a monster. So he's a guy that if you believe in your development staff, which side note every team does, that's why I think it becomes the timeline thing. If you have a pick and like, hey, we can swing for the fence a little bit. If we miss, it's okay. We won't judge this pick for 2 or 3 years. I think McDaniels can be a great option. If you need a guy to be a contributor or get minutes on your roster on a competitive team in the next 1 to 2 seasons, I think you should pass on him. So, you know, high variance, boom or bust, but he's got the physical tools where it's going to be hard for a lot of teams to pass on him.
Yeah, so say, like, I know. I mean, like, how dependent is an organization's player development staff for Jaden McDaniels especially? I think he's one of the most dependent guys in this class, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Just working with different, you know, development staffs, and obviously it's been well documented that Toronto is kind of the epicenter of player development, or maybe you say Miami and Milwaukee shown flashes and other franchises. But is McDaniels one of those guys that needs to be in a good environment to not only grow as a basketball player on the floor, but off the floor as well? I think he has a lot of maturing to do.
So, yeah, I think a developmental situation is going to be huge for McDaniels, kind of because of the timeline. But I think the timeline is more with his body than his skill set. So he's not going to be able to utilize his ball handling, his dribble moves, his pull-up jumper, you know, his ability to get to the rim and play above it if a developmental team can't get his body right. And that's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen in 1 year. Like we were saying with Bamba, you know, it's going to take time. So that's where I think not only from a skill set and coaching perspective, but also a weight room and physicality perspective. I think you have to have both sides of the development click. And when I go through, you know, there are a handful of teams that I know McDaniels from front offices I've talked to, we've discussed him in the mid to late first, kind of depending again on the risk variance there. But I think systems, Toronto obviously makes a ton of sense. I could see the Jazz taking a flyer on him. If I'm Boston, you have 3 picks. If he falls, you know, maybe you take a shot at 17. If he falls to 26 or 30 to you, you can afford to miss. And honestly, what better guys for him to learn how to play from on the perimeter than Tatum and Brown? I mean, right. he's gonna want to mirror his game to theirs. So exactly. I think it all just kind of depends on the situation. Right now, in Babcock Hoops, we do actually have him mocked at 23 to Miami. So interesting, you brought up that team. But it's going to be key. Like, it's going to be the number one contributor to his future success or lack thereof.
Definitely. And I know we were talking kind of before the podcast about, you know, eye test versus analytics approach. You know, what does he do good on the floor versus what do the numbers say? And the numbers are not always not very kind to Jaden McDaniels in particular. You know, negative net rating, very, very low impact. So how do you leverage that comparatively to, you know, the clear base that he has to build off of? Because he does have monster tools, like you mentioned. So, you know, how does that play a factor, I guess, in your evaluation of McDaniels?
Yeah, so I'm pretty hard on people, but I've tried to use a lens with McDaniels of looking at what he can do and not using his negatives to write him off. I understand the hesitation of some people to take him, you know, in the lottery, even the mid first. I probably agree with that stance at this point. But a lot of times in Washington, he was relied on as some possessions a primary ball handler and creator, often a, you know, number two option. And because that's clearly not one of his strengths right now, I look at him as if what tools does he have if you put him on the floor as your third or fourth option? You know, if your third or fourth option is a 6'9 shooter who actually excelled this year as a catch and shooter from three, you know, what does that guy do to your offense? And it elevates you to a whole nother level if he pans out. So if you look at him in a specific role, I think that's where the draw is there, because I don't think it would be wise for a team to select him and kind of make him a first or second option. I mean, not even like a second ball handler or creator until he puts on some weight and shows that he can handle the contact and traffic. But if you've got a fast point guard and, you know, he's got great gravity down at the rim and you kick it and your kick option is a developed Jaden McDaniels, well, now you're cooking. So if you look at him through that lens, he's a guy you could want on your team.
You could kind of see him in kind of that, you know, that support complementary wing on kind of plays both ends. How valuable of a role is that comparatively to like some of the other guys? You know, you could get a Jaden McDaniels spot, because there's a lot of guys that could make a case for, you know, a third option shooter that can be, you know, passable or a slight plus defensively.
Right.
But obviously not many have the base that McDaniels has to build off.
Yeah, and that's where you look at the physical tools. I think other guys that can kind of go in his range, I think you're looking at Elijah Hughes. I'm trying to look at our mock right now to see. I mean, they're not too similar of players, but there are some that are very high on Tyler Bay, and I think you can look at him as a catch and shoot option. Yeah, so I look at them, and McDaniels at that point is considerably younger than both. So at that point, it's not only is he taller than both, longer than both, he's also younger and you have more time to work with him. So I think that's where the draw for him, if you're willing to take the risk, comes into play.
Gotcha. So
just another point on McDaniels before we kind of end off and move on to Balmaro, another guy you did a scouting report on. Check that out. You know, how do you gauge what he brought to the table and what he could be, you know, projected as defensively? Because obviously Washington 2-3 zone, and I, you know, at 1.4 blocks per game, I think you mentioned in an article that, you know, he did impact winning in some ways, but also that it is hard to kind of gauge when you have a guy like McDaniels who's sitting at the bottom of a 2-3 zone, obviously. So, you know, I think that's a big part of how he can provide, you know, value and impact on an NBA floor. How do you view him as a potential defender at the next level?
Yeah, so I think positionally, because of his length, and he's fairly light on his feet on defense in a good way. Like, he's obviously light and gets bumped around, but he can show lateral quickness and decent mobility at times. So I look at him as a guy who can play on the perimeter, but then in a very short amount of time, shrink the floor. Just boom, he can close lanes. He can get to the lane and contest the shot. So I see him as a guy where it's like, if you have to hide somebody on offense, he's a guy that can possibly overcome that in the future. Because he's already shown flashes of it. You know, the 1.4 blocks a game, a lot of good contests, you know, good instincts as a help defender, decent rotations at times. He does have a tendency to fall asleep every once in a while. I don't know if that's, you know, maybe it's him, maybe it's the zone. But I see him as a guy that can shrink the floor. My issue on defense is the fouls. 103 fouls on the season, and also led the Pac-12 in technicals. Just, you got to stay under control. Has no clue how to stay straight up. That is where, again, I didn't want to hammer him on the negatives, but it was, look at what he can be. He doesn't know how to stay straight up and contest. He sees the shot and he's like, oh yeah, I'm sending this into the fourth row. And he just leads to a ton of fouls. So I love the aggressive nature. He still had 40 blocks. If you learn how to stay straight up and just have a little bit of maturity and discipline, well, now you've got a guy who can alter anything. So that's what I like his potential defensively.
I think that'll come with, you know, the strength program and, you know, player development as well, because, you know, that's kind of one of the aspects of him that I think has a huge variance if you can, you know, really obviously strengthen him out.
Yeah, because right now if somebody puts a shoulder into him, it's over. Like, he's out of the way, he's done.
Yeah, he's going to crumple or, you know, bend, fold in like that. You know, it's going to be fouls for days. So definitely improving that core and lower body strength, I think, is going to be key early on for a development program. And you know, that's totally, totally feasible for a guy at, you know, that's going to be like 19 years old.
Right.
So, you know, I wouldn't worry too much about it in a few years, but that early on, that's probably one of the first things I'd be looking to fix if I'm a, you know, development staff. And if we want to move on to Leandro Balmaro, I'd love to hear your thoughts on him, because you did great stuff on him as well. And I really enjoyed reading your work on him. So
I would love to discuss Valmero, because he is one of my guys in this class. I absolutely love him. I love his game. I want him on my team. Valmero, man, versatile, secondary ball handler, high energy, bouncy feet. And again, those things do cause problems at times. But man, I love his activity on both sides, like change of speeds, change of direction. He does not ever want to pass with two hands. He wants to just be flashy all the time, and he can do it. Like transition, half court, like excellent passer. He's got great vision, and he's played different levels of professional basketball and, you know, spent a good amount of time. I want to say up until all the COVID stuff, I think it was 7 or 8 games with the EuroLeague team. And man, even though some of the finishing numbers were iffy, I really want him on my team. You know, he's energetic, he's relentless, and has real promise as a playmaker. So I think he would be, I would not let him fall too far in this class.
Having two-way playmakers is, you know, it's very valuable. And every time I watch Valmero, other than, you know, the passing, as you mentioned, you know, he's kind of ambidextrous with his approach, mm-hmm. and just loves, you know, using those live dribble passes, which is really coveted. And if you can get that in a secondary playmaker, that's awesome. But yeah. I absolutely love his defense. I think that's going to be his calling card from, you know, day one alongside, you know, his playmaking, because those are two things teams are going to want him on the floor to do. And, you know, I think that's really unique to get a guy, you know, that's 6'7" guard that can, you know, do both those things at a high level. You know, it's really valuable to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's so competitive. You know, we had 16 steals in 9 games, Barcelona B. He had 12 steals in 13 games with Barcelona A. And he was only playing 11 minutes a game. So it's not like he was getting these with 30, 35 minutes. Like, he's just so active on the ball, and he's willing. He's willing to throw his body around. He's willing to get in there, bust up pick and rolls on ISO. He's just all over you, which, again, there are a lot of fouls, but they're not stupid, lazy fouls. There, he got too aggressive. Come on, man, maybe we're going to teach you not to jump there at that point. That wasn't a risk worth taking. But it's not, I'm lazy, didn't move my feet, so I guess I'll swing and try to hope for the steal. Like, it wasn't those. So that's where the stats, you know, the foul numbers, sometimes you may shy somebody away, but I wouldn't look too much into that. The only thing on defense, he's not very long. He's 6'7", but I think, if I remember correctly, he might have a 6'8"-ish, 6'9" wingspan. Like, it's not crazy long. So that can hinder him at times. But like you're saying, the defense, at least early on, that could be his calling card for a while.
Yeah. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on his shot, because that's one thing I've been up and down on. I've heard, you know, a lot of good things about his ability to learn and, you know, coachability and all that. So a lot of people are buying his shot development. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So the shooting was probably going to be the swing skill for him in his NBA career. You know, he's right at, if not right under, 30% for 3-point shooting this season at both levels. Inconsistent, kind of streaky. But from a development curve perspective, his mechanics have improved over the last year. And one of the things that I think is important is to note that he was asked pretty quickly to not play a, quote, significant role with Barca A, but it was, hey, all right, you're dominating Barca B, so let's bring you up here. And at 11 minutes a game, a lot of time during, you know, in key moments and important parts of these EuroLeague games, what 18, 19-year-old is not going to get in and mentally press? Like, hey, this is my time to shine. I'm going to make the most of it. So some of his shot selection I see as him deciding, on one hand, it's, okay, I don't want to take this look because I'm a little timid and I don't want to screw up for my team. So that throws off the shot. On the other hand, it's, do I take this shot because this is my only playing time tonight, so I'm going to take it. So the shot selection is what was questionable for me, and not necessarily the shot itself. So I will not overlook the fact that his Barca B shooting wasn't great, but I buy the shot and his ability to develop into a, hopefully, a league average shooter, if you will, that, again, as long as you can command somewhat of respect from the defenders, they don't have to think you're Steph Curry, but as long as they don't just drag off of you and go under every single pick and roll, then I think he's going to be just fine.
Yeah, I totally agreed there.
It's anytime you see, you know, anytime we hear Derek, he's got the claps going in the background, and he's raving in on Balmaro, wanting him on his team and whatnot. You should probably listen in. But who wouldn't want to get excited about a guy who's 6'7", like you said, that, you know, even sometimes picks up full court defensively, ultra competitive. It fights through screens on the perimeter. That's my favorite thing, at least to watch. You know, when I'm watching Balmaro film, is just how competitive, like you said, he is, but like primarily defensively. I know we've had a little inner rivalry this year on Pokuvis versus Balmaro in terms of international guys. But
I noticed Pokusevski wasn't on my questions list before this.
Yeah, I'm always happy to talk about Poku, man.
If we got to bring out Poku for this, maybe we might have to.
You're singing Ethan's tune right now.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, I was not one of the few guys that got their synergy glitched and got to watch the rest of Poku's Olympiakos game. So that was a sad day.
Right.
But
I will go one more note on Balmaro, not on court related, but a big piece of these international guys is their contract and buyouts if they play for good teams over in Europe. Right. People thought early on that Balmaro's contract was going to be a couple million dollars. Now that is something that absolutely can make a team hesitate on taking him. But Matt recently confirmed that the buyout, he talked to the agent and the team, it's only $900,000. So Balmaro himself would only have to pay $150,000 of it if he wanted to come over next season, which again, do you take him as a stash? You'll bring him over immediately? I don't know. But the contract is more favorable than originally thought to getting him in your system early.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed on some of these contracts, like $2 million, when I heard that, you know, being floated around, I was like, that's a ludicrous amount for some of the buyouts I've seen comparatively, because, you know, that's such a, you know, if you're a team, that's such a, you know, that's not a good incentive to pick a guy. So, you know, I'm glad Matt confirmed that, because
and
definitely don't want that misinformation causing any issues with Bulmer.
Right. And shameless Babcock Poops plug, Jeremy Berman put out an article probably a couple months ago on how those international contracts work. Jeremy's work is always awesome. Does a lot of the research for us. I learned a lot of stuff from reading that. I didn't know exactly how, what amounts, percentages, you know, the team paid, player played, all that kind of stuff. But it's worth checking out on the website if you want to go read Jeremy's work.
For sure. So another guy that you've recently put out a report on, someone who I think is just extremely interesting. I mentioned on the last podcast that I've started to rise on Cassius Stanley recently after dropping a little bit. But I mean, let's talk about Cassius Stanley, because he's certainly an interesting prospect, certainly one of those guys who hopes to become a 3-and-D guy on an NBA team. And a super interesting stat I shouted out on the last podcast too, I think you put it out, that every single one of his threes this year were off assists, or off the catch, off assists, whatever it was. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on Cassius Stanley. What do you project him to become early on in his career?
For sure. So, 100% of his three-point attempts were assisted. Just an absolutely wild number. Good thing about him is we actually did a Q&A with him as well, and he addressed it. He was like, I know it's a part I need to work on. I have been working on it. But a lot of it was system and role related. So I think while a lot of people look at that as, again, not you, but I think a lot of people look at that as, oh, wow, he can't do these things. Like, look, while it's not a strength, his role at Duke, because they were so talented, was niched in a certain way. And he was only allowed and asked to do certain things. So a lot of these things that he, quote, can't do, according to some, I believe is unfair. So that's one of the things that I remain high on Stanley. I think he's a mid to late first guy, probably late first, because there are some concerns with me. But man, he's a phenomenal athlete. I would say he's probably the best athlete in the class. 6'6", jumped a 46.5-inch vertical when he got to campus, you know, broke Zion's record. Shot 36% from three, hit 31 of 86, so it wasn't on some small volume, and 100% assisted. So similar to the McDaniels role that I believe, you know, I mentioned earlier, I think if he's a guy that is a spot-up shooter for your team and also a transition nightmare for opponents, I think there's really, really good value on that. Relentless work ethic as well, like good character, good kid. And I think he's just a guy you want in your organization.
Quick point on Stanley. So, you know, at Sierra Canyon, even at Harvard Westlake before that, I don't know if you've watched much of his high school tape, but he was often a guy that had the ball in his hands offensively and was doing more than just hitting threes, you know, off the catch, if you will. He's self-creating. Do you see that as part of his upside, or is that a little bit far-fetched for the NBA level for him? Because we didn't really see much of Cassius Stanley's self-creation at Duke.
Right. So if he goes high, this is the part of his game that I would be comfortable saying, okay, like the high school tape of him handling the ball and him wanting to do that in the future, that is why they took him. Because you're right, we didn't see that at all. But again, that was Duke, whether that was not letting him or just the system not designed for him to do so. Right. You know, again, he does answer in that article for us, but it's, yeah, as soon as I realized that that was a part of his game beforehand, I was considerably more comfortable with him. Because if all you have ever been is a catch and shoot, spot up shooter, that's one thing. Like you said, like, it doesn't mean you can't do that in the future. And who knows, maybe he wants to actually have the ball in his hand more. Do I see him being a reliable pick and roll guy, perimeter creator? Not necessarily, but I don't think he's a guy that is limited in the sense that he can't do it. You know, he filled his specific role. He did exactly what he was asked to do. But I do think, like you said, he's more comfortable with the ball in his hand than the tape showed this season. So if you want to play the upside, that's absolutely part of it.
Yeah, that's a good point about Stanley. If we want to move on to two of my personal favorite players in the class, and currently my number one and two on my big board, Killian Hayes and Denny Avdija. I know we've both been Killian Hayes fans for quite a while, but I'd love to hear you talk about him and some of the value that he's going to bring to the next level, because I'm completely sold on Killian.
Yep. Love Hayes. He's comfortably a top 3-4, maybe so, guy for me. You know, I think he can be your primary ball handler, primary creator. You know, one of the best live dribble passers. His live dribble passing is really, really solid. Can do it from anywhere on the floor. And he's becoming a multi-level scorer. You know, his shot isn't something in the past that has been a big part of his game. But some of his step backs lately and his footwork, they are just improving at a rapid rate. You know, you can go and see some of his tape from last year to this year, and it's just incredible how good he's gotten. Again, like I said with SGA, there was like a clear from this point in the film to this point, this kid got better, and I'm willing to bet on him continuing to do so. You know, not many bad decisions. He's a high IQ player. There can be some issues on defense, but the effort is often there. And just a guy who can be your lead ball handler, I really like him, and I think he's going to develop into a really, really good player.
Yeah, and defensively, I think, you know, some of those concerns come with being a very young guy in a men's league. But I saw him get notably better in a lot of areas, you know, just whether that's making the right read on defense or being in the right spot. So I'm buying his defense being at the very least passable moving forward and not a negative. Yeah. But, you know, the biggest thing with Hayes for me is just, you know, you mentioned with the live dribble passing, he is a pick and roll genius. Mm-hmm. I mean, he makes some of the highest level reads you'll see in an 18-year-old, you know, at the time, 17-year-old prospect. You know, the way he sees the game out of the pick and roll and the way he can get to that live dribble pass to execute his vision is, you know, that's what's so enticing for me.
Yeah. And now what he's doing is he's mixing it up with a step back three.
I know.
Which he hasn't had in the past, so it's even more of a threat. And that is where the ceiling gets raised on his game. If that becomes a part of his arsenal. I mean, he's hitting, moving to left and right, these Harden-esque, how many steps did he just take, step back three, and he's hitting them.
Yeah. And, you know, that's going to be huge moving forward for his development because, you know, a lot of the times, I know early on in the season, before he really started showing off this, you know, these kind of moves, and his shot in general, you know, the big question was, will he be able to, you know, leverage his shot to get defenses to go under or on him or to get them to go over rather.
Right.
And, you know, he's far and away past that now. I think, you know, he was pulling up on defenses with no hesitation if they dared to go under him. And you know, I really, really liked watching him develop. You know, he just seems like a super smart kid. You know, a guy worth buying his development moving forward. And, you know, that's absolutely the kind of guy I'd want, you know, heading my team as far as, you know, an initiate or a creator and, you know, primary ball handler. You know, maybe he might not be a star, but, you know, I mean, granted, he could be. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a really safe bet for me, which is why he's number one for me.
Yeah, and it's not like he's small like a lot of these guards. This kid's, you know, 6'5", 6'5 and a half, decently long arms.
Yeah.
Like, he's a big kid. So, people who might not watch a lot of international basketball, I don't want them to lump him into some of these smaller guards either. Like, he's got the NBA size already.
One thing, because I see this all the time with Hayes, just like a minor concern, and I know Alex's point on it, but, you know, the thing that constantly comes up is that, you know, he only went left, or he's prone to go left, and that's what he's done, is he's left-hand dominant. Do you see that being much of an issue? I don't put much stock into it, because, I mean, there's never any talk about guys who go right all the time. So I think it's not much of a concern for me, but something at least worth monitoring.
Right. Then that is precisely my point every time. Who do we get pissed at for going right? Nobody. Nobody. So while, yes, like, there are points of, do you ask the question, is he only so comfortable with his left that he doesn't ever want to go right? Like, can we break that? Can we break him of that habit and tendency? Maybe you can, maybe you can't. That is not anywhere near glaring enough of an issue for me to stay away from him. So while it's not something to just glaze over as if it's not there, but it's nothing that makes me stop. Like, I wouldn't pass because of it.
Definitely. And one more concern, I guess, that some people have mentioned is Hayes' ability to play off the ball. And I know my points on this are rather, I've said them quite a few times, but he definitely was a guy that had to make strides off the ball a little bit. And, you know, his footwork, he didn't always seem comfortable. You know, his footwork was up and down at times, but I thought it got a lot better. I was curious about your perception about his potential play off the ball, because he has the size and, you know, at least the shooting upside to do it, my opinion.
Right. And it's going to come down to his shooting. His off ball, it'll come down to shooting, and I'm probably just that, at least early on. There's nothing about his game right now that makes me say he can't. But I also wouldn't draft him to put him in a system to where it's even a 50-50 on off ball. Like, I take him and I want him on the ball all the time. So yes, if the shooting is there, sure, yes, you could throw out some lineups with him off of it. But I also wouldn't want that as like a primary or even like a lot of time responsibility for him.
And exactly. Another thing is that, like, you know, you've seen people going with that, playing off the ball, questioning his off-the-catch shooting. I personally say, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, that if he's doing what he's doing off the dribble right now, if he's on that developmental curve, of now, you know, shooting step backs and side to side and making fadeaways and all the other things he's doing off the dribble, I'm not really worried about him off the catch. I think that's something that he's going to acquire and pick up over time, which honestly could take his off-ball value to another tier level.
Right. And I don't think he's going to be a guy who, even if he does excel off the catch and shoot, I don't think he's going to be like a runaround screens type of guy anyway. So I think his just a catch and shooter as maybe a little movement or a relocation or something. Like I said, as long as that's there, then I'm comfortable with him in that role. But I would never try to turn him into a pure two or anything like that.
Yeah. And, you know, you're right, drafting him to put him on the ball. That's where his value is, you know, far right, and away better than, you know, that's why he's arguably a number one player, or as in your eyes, a top three player. So I want to go into another guy that's I've seen him top two. I've seen him even at one. I've also seen him in like late lottery. What are your thoughts on Denny Avdija, and what do you see on his role? Like, what's your perception of his role going forward?
Yeah. So Avdija, I think, is awesome. He's another guy comfortably in that probably 4 to 7-ish, 4 to 8-ish range, depending on fit. 6'9" combo forward. I like him as a point forward, small ball four, however you want to use him in today's NBA. I think that fits Denny and his skill set really, really well. You know, 6'9", loves to run the transition, is comfortable with the ball in his hands, tough, physical kid, a hard-nosed competitor. I mean, this kid just wants to win all the time, and he wants nothing more. And again, like these other guys, you can see his development year to year. Tends to dominate guys his own age, playing some EuroLeague minutes, similar to Balmero in the sense that while it's not a ton of minutes at times, it's meaningful enough that when he does perform well, you're like, okay, this kid has what it takes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, talking about that motor he has, you know, that's one of the reasons he's the top guy for me is I love guys that love to win. And Avdija really has that energy and that competitive fire that I think will drive him to really make a lot of improvements down the road. And when I scouted him back in, I believe it was December, you know, he was a lot thinner. His shot was not nearly as effective as it's been in this recent period. You know, take it as you will. But he got so much heavier. You know, he put on legit muscle. And, you know, it takes a – I know he's, you know, obviously in a good training program and all that, but he has the work ethic, I think, to really push himself to be, you know, great in a sense. Whether that's in a glue guy role or, you know, as a combo forward, as you mentioned, or a modern four, or even a, you know, a secondary initiator. So, you know, I really am buying that moving forward with Avdija.
And I've got a couple of buddies who work for teams in that Israeli league in various roles. And they just tell me that he just eats, sleeps, and breathes basketball. Like, that is just what he wants all the time. And that's where I'm in. Like, work ethic. And these guys on other teams have said, like, that's all this kid wants to do is be good at basketball. And I'm like, man, like, that's it. Like, you, like, Ethan mentioned earlier, that's just your winning impact. And I'll bet on, like, not only is he's also good. Like, it's not like he sucks.
Yeah, he's very good.
Oh, he's so good. He's going to be good. Like, he's already good. So I think a big thing with this is his shot. Like, his shooting has obviously been in question in the past. And well, you don't want to fall victim to videos of an empty gym.
Recency bias and all that.
He's been working on that shot. And to be fair, I think it was Schmitz or somebody who said, like, over his past, you know, the four games since all the virus stuff has kind of calmed down and they start playing basketball, in a very small sample, his three-point shooting has improved. So if that turns on and he's even league average, like, watch out. Like, this kid could be so, so good. So the shooting is going to be – I don't think it's a floor for him. I think his floor is comfortable where it is. I think the three-point shot is a ceiling raiser, and that would just be humongous for him.
I mean, I remember even me and Alex talking about his three-point shooting as like a major swing skill for him back on our mock draft episode before this kind of period even started. And, you know, again, like you guys are saying, small sample size, but I'm a lot more comfortable with the strides he's made, and especially just mechanically too. His upper body is so much different than what it was last year in terms of just fluidity and how the shot looks, his release point and everything. I'm a lot more comfortable with buying Avdija as at least a league average guy, if not definitely more from the three-point line. And, I mean, that's just going to provide so much value for his game.
Right. And I just pulled up the Mike Schmitz tweet. July 6th, he said, let's see, in the five games since Israel returned to play, he's shooting 48% from three.
Man.
Yeah.
And it's bound to regress, of course. But I mean, you know, if he's even 10% lower than that.
Yeah, if you tell me right now Denny's going to be a 38% shooter from three, I might take him one.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that swing skill, you know, maybe he doesn't get to a 38 on volume, but, you know, I think it's pretty feasible he gets to, you know, a 34. You know, a 36 maybe.
Yeah, like I said earlier, just respectable. Just don't sag off of him.
Yeah, and God forbid he gets to 38 or, you know, close 40. To 40. Yeah, it's like, I mean, geez, that's a guy that's gonna be a very lethal weapon on the offensive.
God
end.
Forbid he's shooting 48% in his first NBA season.
You got me dreaming on him now. But, yeah. Huge Avdija fan. So that's why those guys are 1 and 2. Ethan, I think you wanted to talk about some of like the guys that Derek is kind of higher or lower on.
Yeah, just kind of trying to gauge. Right. Yeah, I mean, this is a draft that's so variant. And, you know, there's mocks that have guys like, for example, Tyrese Maxey, whatever, top 10. And then there's other mocks like I've seen on Babcock Hoops where he's even second round or, you know, 31, 30 occasionally. So kind of just trying to gauge where you are on some of the bigger names in this class. Let's start right off with definitely a polarizing guy, someone who's extremely interesting. A lot of his, lack of success this year could be attributed to the situation that he was in. But there's obviously other intel on him floating around and other things. But Cole Anthony, are you, would you say higher or lower than the consensus on Cole Anthony?
So for this, I love this part, and I'm going to break it up where I am compared to the media and where I am compared to, we'll call them draft Twitter, because I know that your listener base is kind of a mix of both. And a lot of these players are seen very differently in those two kind of sectors of the game. So I want to break that up. So when it comes to the media, Cole Anthony, I'm lower. And when it comes to draft Twitter, I am way, way lower. A lot of it is non-basketball related. The intel is just not good, start to finish. And just not a guy I want on my team. From a basketball perspective, I don't think he is as explosive and dominant as some people say. I think he can be a solid point guard, but his I think defensively he's going to get pushed around a little bit. He's not very long, you know, pretty short arms, and I just don't see him being the you know, a top 10 player that some do. I just don't see that. So I think you're looking mid to late first on Cole Anthony. It wouldn't shock me if he slipped till the back end of the first. Again, that's not to say that, like, I think he's a bad player. I just don't hold him in the same regard as a lot of other people in the media or on Twitter.
Yeah, I get that. And, you know, bringing it back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, he really didn't fit some of the, you know, early intangible evaluation you have on Anthony, which is really kind of a shame because, you know, how talented he is. But, you know, what do you see his role as at the NBA level?
So I think you're looking at a guy, he can be your primary point guard, you know, can be an engine scorer when he needs to be. He'll put pressure on the opposing defenses, but his decision-making and, you know, his shot selection will need to improve. He had trouble scoring at the rim in North Carolina, and his assist numbers weren't great. And this is where I'll back off and give him a little bit of credit, because the situation, quite frankly, could not have been worse for him. There are a lot of times where it's like the guys he was kicking to, they weren't going to hit those shots. So I'm not going to hold low assist numbers against him as if he's a bad passer, because that's not the case. I'm also not going to hold some of his finishing issues against him, because he was driving into lanes that were so clogged. It's like,
he had 90 spacing, looking, man.
Yeah, it's like, what do you want anybody to do? You know, so I'm not going to hold those against him. He is strong, like good feet, good straight line, but I don't think he's as, you know, as explosive or will just be as dominant as some people think. But offensive initiator, and if his shooting is even league average at all, you know, he'll hit some jumpers. He's able to hit some tough shots. So I think he'll be able to get you points. But defense, I think at the next level is right now, it's like I'm not totally sure what you're going to get there. So it could become a liability to an extent.
I think.
Do you think he could – go ahead, go ahead.
I think anytime that you have a guy who almost regressed in a way athletically since his high school days, since his days playing AAU basketball to the collegiate level, where it almost looked – and I know there was injury concerns and things that happened, but he did not look, you know, athletically prepared for the jump from even high school to college basketball at some point this year.
A lot of that, I think his mixtapes were so good – that it made us think that's what he was going to come in and do.
Right.
So it's like, right. I don't want to hold that against him, but yeah. when the only highlights you get of him are just like, whoa, he is above the rim and above everybody. And then at Carolina, while that did happen, it wasn't like the primary part of his game.
Exactly. Yeah.
So do you think he'll be able to drive winning and kind of that high usage primary, almost, you know, secondary engine role? Because that's a tough role to drive winning in if you're not elite.
I wouldn't draft him and expect him to be that leader of my offense for the future. Number two option, you know, secondary ball handler, sure. I think I can get on board with that. But I wouldn't pick Anthony in the same way that I would pick, you know, LaMelo or Hayes. It's like, hey, you're going to be the guy. I want the ball in your hand for the future. Like, I do not see Cole Anthony that way.
So do you think he could play – like, what role would you see him playing on a winning team then? Like, I kind of thought as, like, your bench initiator or, you know, even a, you know, potential, you know, high-usage primary off the bench. But I'm struggling to see a guy like him driving winning in a lower-usage role. So you got
because his shooting, because his shooting isn't an elite level to where you're like, oh, okay, this kid comes in, like, I'm getting threes. That's not him either. So I see, I definitely agree with what you're saying on that.
Also, another guy that kind of fits into that mold, and we talked about him right before we started into this higher lower thing, but Tyrese Maxey. You know, I'm still not all the way there on you know, what his potential role could be. Me and Alex have gone back and forth on it on past podcasts. But, you know, are you higher or lower on Tyrese Maxey, obviously from the media and then draft Twitter?
Yeah, draft Twitter, way lower. Media, I'd say I'm lower, but really not that far. I think he's comfortably a mid-first round pick guy. Babcock Hoops, we have him late first. There are multiple NBA teams that have, you know, told us don't expect him to get to picked in the late first. But if a team does pick him early, even late lottery, like, I get it. He's probably one of the most fun guys I watch. Like, I enjoy watching him finish in the lane. He is so creative. He's so flexible, ambidextrous. Like, he can get it around anybody up to the rim. And I think that's really, really important, especially with an NBA floor that's going to open up more. If he can get to the rim at all, like, I think he'll be able to finish. The question that a lot of teams have is, against NBA bigs, does that finishing remain as effective as it was in college? And that's what it comes down to, I think, for him, as well as the three-point shooting. I think he's a better three-point shooter than the numbers in college showed. I forget, what was he, 28, 29%? I don't know.
28.
If y'all have 28.
Yeah.
Do I think he's that poor of a three-point shooter? Absolutely not. He's going to be able to shoot better than that. My question is, why do people just say, hey, I know he shot 28% from three, but he's going to be elite at the next level? It's like, I don't understand, I just don't get that part of, he's just given.
No, he's going to have to make strides. He's going to have to make strides.
On Twitter, we don't believe that number. I don't know. So that just gets me fired up sometimes.
100%. He's going to have to – my thing has always been on him. I am one of the few – I don't even know if it's the few anymore, because I feel like everybody's now projecting him to be, like you said, an elite shooter. But I think he has projectable skills and projectable indicators from his shooting range from behind the arc that will make him a decent three-point shooter. But that's going to come with time. That's not something that's going to happen right away. He's not going to be a 40%+ off dribble, off catch, you know, whatever you want from day one. That's also what I don't understand about Maxey. And honestly, like, all he has to really be in my eyes to return value, and he's someone that I've dropped a little bit on recently, is kind of like we talked about, I think, Alex, last episode, in that bench initiator, potential secondary initiator role, where he's scoring but also carrying weight with his point of attack defense, which is something, you know, people making an argument for Maxey don't talk about how good he is perimeter-wise defensively. If you're making an argument for him top five or top three or even top one that I saw a few months ago, which blew my mind, why are you not talking about how good he is defensively,
right,
like guarding opposing ones and twos?
Right, and that's where I think that's part of the game that keeps me with him in the mid-first round is – I do believe that he'll be a decent defender at the next level. He's high energy. He'll get up on you. Good hands, good feet, good hips. He's got all the things I want in the defender, except elite size. And that is the concern. That is the concern when I talk to teams of, okay, why are you lower on Maxey than the media? Well, at 6'2.5", I don't buy the full 6'3". Again, I don't buy a lot of guys' height because teams just lie to you sometimes. So let's give him 6'2.5", 6'3". Some teams don't know if he's a one or a two. And the inability to be able to decide right now, this is the role for him on my team, you know, that's kind of where the hesitations come in. Like you said, is he a secondary or primary initiator off the bench? Kind of a combo guard, sure. But if you put him in the starting lineup, I don't know what position exactly he plays, who exactly he defends. I don't think he's a good enough passer right now to be your point guard. So I think his biggest competitors in this draft, interestingly, is Haliburton and Hampton. I think Haliburton, Hampton, and Maxey are your – they can all kind of play the one. They can all kind of play the two. None of them are bad at any of those, but they're none of them are so elite at one either. I'm really, really excited to see where those three end up relative to each other, because I think organizations will look at them fairly similarly, even though their skill sets aren't necessarily the same.
That's a lot. You know, that's an interesting point, because when you look at guys like Tyrese Maxey and RJ Hampton, some of their main value is, you know, that ability to break down defenses and, you know, have potential scoring versatility, as well as, you know, decent defensive chops. Halliburton is not a guy that you're going to use to break down defenses. You're going to use him as a game manager. And, you know, I think that hopefully, right. Yeah. And I really like his shooting indicators. I think his shot does not get enough credit, because it is very, very good. And, you know, his form is, it looks a little funny, but it's really, really nice. You know, I like his touch. I think he'll be able to score at an off-ball roll a lot easier than maybe a Maxey or even an RJ Hampton right off the bat. You know, I think he's got more of that glue guy skill set comparatively. But, you know, for guys that are in that combo guard mold where you're not entirely sure what they're going to play, it will be really interesting to watch how those three guys find their roles in the NBA.
Right. So, yeah, I'll finish. I feel the need, because I feel like some are just going to get really, really offended and personally attacked at my Maxey slander, even though I don't think by me saying he's a mid-first-round pick is slander. Even though I'm way lower than some people, like, I still believe in him at the next level. I don't think he'll fall to the end of the first. I think he's a competitor. Like you said, people don't talk about his defense enough. It's legit, and it's awesome. So I'm comfortable taking him in the middle. Just not quite as high as some, that's all.
Completely understandable. And it's a really good point, too, about, like, when we're talking about, you know, shooting indicators, at least for me, it's not something that happens overnight. It's okay, can he make these mechanical changes to his shot? Can he take the touch that he had on floaters and the success that he had on long twos, contested twos, and can he combine all of those things to then become at least a league average or slightly above average three-point shooter? The word elite should not be used with someone who's 28% in college.
Right. And as hard as I am on him, to your original question, I still think the answer is yes, because his touch is so good. And even though his shot's a little low, like, he gets it off. He gets it off in traffic. He gets it off contested. Like, I think he'll shoot just fine.
100%. So another guy, and this is probably the biggest name, if you will, media-wise, or maybe LaMelo at this point, but for a while it was James Wiseman. Higher or lower on James Wiseman from a draft Twitter standpoint and then also from the media?
Yeah, so higher than draft Twitter, lower than the media. I understand completely why both kind of sectors have him where they do. I totally understand it. There are concerns, like, on defensively, you know, his feet, his basketball IQ, his rotations. I understand the shot selection issues. I understand the NBA guys and the media who see a 7'1", 235-pound guy who, it's like, why not bet on him? Why not take a shot on him? I think the biggest issue with Wiseman is he got so used to just straight up bullying people in high school that the finesse and touch and quick decision making and correct decision making he had to display in those first couple games, like, it was lacking. It wasn't there. So for those who are tough on him, I totally get it. And to an extent, I'm not even really going to tell them that I disagree, but I don't know if I would take him in the, you know, top one, two, or three. Him versus Okongwu, honestly, there are a lot of – you catch me on the right day, I'm taking Okongwu ahead of him. And to some, that's a hot take. To some, it's not. But I think Wiseman kind of fits right in that middle ground, a little bit lower than the media. Higher than probably draft Twitter, but if I had to pick which I'm closer to, I put him closer to, you know, the top 10, middle of the top 10, and that's ultimately where I think he'll go.
I think you put a great point on Wiseman a while ago that I saw on Twitter, and it's that, yes, you could draft him to be an above average 82 game player, but when we're talking about a 16 game playoff big man, will he provide value? And my answer is that scares me. If you're picking him to be someone that's going to be either A, your engine, then you're doing it wrong offensively, or, you know, in some capacity, someone who's going to provide scoring on different levels, then I worry about him, you know, especially pick and roll wise, guarding the pick and roll. I worry especially just about him in a playoff setting potentially.
And that's where I look at Okongwu as more of a 16. So that's where it's like, hey, if we intend on being a contender pretty quickly, Okongwu is likely the guy because he's not going to get eaten alive in pick and roll or, you know, switch situations. It's just not going to happen. Or I'll put it this way. It's way less likely to happen to him than it is to Wiseman. So I still believe kind of in that take that I had, and I still look at him where if you want him for, you know, 82 games, get to the playoffs, sure. And I just don't know if you can put him on the floor in the last 5 minutes of a Eastern Conference or Western Conference finals and be like, hey, I need you to go out there and win me the game. I don't know if I see that quite yet. But with his size and tool, like, you can get there. But I understand why people are low on him. So that's not one of the hills I'm willing to die on.
So another guy that's almost kind of similar, but Obi Toppin. Maybe, you know, obviously I have no idea what to do with him defensively. Higher, lower on Toppin, you know, from both standpoints.
Similar to Wiseman, I'm a little bit lower than the media and probably higher than draft Twitter. His defense absolutely concerns me. Stiffness, hips, feet, everything. I mean, there will be some point guards in the NBA that play him right off the floor, and that is a legitimate concern. And for those low on him, I totally get it. What I don't buy are the people who think that his offense won't make up for that, at least to an extent. Toppin's going to be able to score. I think he's going to be able to shoot better than some people think he can. I think he's going to be great off the catch, off movement towards the goal. You know, running the baseline, alley oops, lob target, pick and roll lob guy. Like, he's going to get his points. So I think his offensive value is going to be great enough to keep him on the floor. But I totally understand the defensive concerns, and I completely get that.
Yeah. So one conversation we had a while back is the playoff versus regular season bigs. I know you touched on it with Wiseman, but how does your evaluation change if you get a guy like Toppin who, I mean, you put it pretty well, you know, there's a lot of point guards that are going to play him off the court. Mm-hmm. And especially in playoff situations when they're looking to attack those matchups, maybe not as much in regular season, but definitely in the playoffs. So if you can't keep him on the floor for his defensive value, you know, because obviously he'll be good offensively. I don't think there's any disputing that. You know, how does that change your view of Toppin if, you know, you're looking to be a playoff team?
So while it is scary, there's also a point to where you have to look around as a front office or a team and say, you know, you can't pass on so many guys because you still have to go win most of those 82.
Right.
So that's where I look at Wiseman, like, oh, you can't play him in the playoffs. Okay, but you still got to win enough to get
there.
And that is where I look at Wiseman and Toppin. And I said, you know what, they've got the tools. And I think Toppin has a scoring where you still take him because he can get you there.
That's interesting. That's very different than our opinions, but I totally get that perspective.
Yeah, because, I mean, this has been – that was one of the most eye-opening, you know, discussions we had a few episodes ago, was just on Toppin. How impactful will he really be? And then we started comparing him to Isaiah Stewart even, which is who we're going to talk about next. But, like, and what I'm hearing is, Derek, you value his offense to a point, which is completely understandable, that it will return value despite his defensive struggles.
Yes, I do. To a level that in the finals, do you take him off the floor? Possibly. But I don't see that. Like, I see him scoring enough over the season in the playoffs if you get there. Like, I just think his offensive value will be enough to where you take him, you play him, and he's a guy you want on your team.
Does it worry you, though, like, a guy who had the usage numbers that he did, the ball in his hands as much as he did, the offense that he was in at Dayton, does it worry you, like, if he's potentially going to a situation where all those numbers regress, if he's in a lesser role, could that minimize his potential offensive value in a way?
I don't know, because I think you take the best of what he does, and on an NBA team, that's just what you have him do.
Yeah.
Like, and so I don't look at a regressed usage as a bad thing. I think it's, hey, we know what you excel at, and we're just going to use you like that the whole year. And you are just going to dominate at the few things I ask you to do. Like, he, I mean, his athleticism, obviously left to right, is iffy. But I mean, as a lob guy, no one else in this class you want more, and it's not even close.
Right.
So you look at teams who have ball handlers that can penetrate and want a lob, Toppin's your guy. And if that's what he does at an elite level, that, and again, he can shoot 39% from the year, or from three on the season, hit on taking 3.5 a game. Like, not only is a lob, he's not just going to clog the paint. Like, you can put him out on the perimeter and let him shoot sometimes as well. So I think you just take, if the use drops, but he's still doing those things at a high level, you still have a great offensive addition to your team.
Completely understandable. Also an excellent passer out of the post from what I've seen too. And it makes sense putting him in situations to where it plays to his strengths. I could definitely see that, you know, returning value. I still worry about, you know, the disparity between, is he such a negative on defense that it just makes him a negative as a whole, but yeah. It does make sense.
And I get it. And again, it does worry me. It's hard for me to sit and take a stance and say that won't happen to Toppin.
You do make a good point. You know, you need to get to the playoffs, and if this is a guy that's going to help you out in the regular season by giving you, you know, 16-7 or, you know, whatever every night, mm-hmm. you know, that's valuable. And, you know, it may not be, you know, the end-all be-all, you know, yeah. for a contender, but it's going to help you get there.
Yeah, and that's where I look at Minnesota as a great potential fit for him, because yeah. he's a guy that in the playoffs, if you want to go Towns and – a bunch of wings and ball handlers, because that's what the 16 games is going to require. Their roster is good enough to can be good enough to do that. But during the course of the year, I see Toppin on lobs. You run a pick and pop with Towns outside and Toppin inside, you're going to win a lot of games. Like, there are a lot of points to be had there. So that's where I look. And it's like, hey, even if you can't play him a ton in the playoffs at the end of the game, and you want to go a little smaller with the Towns of the five, but I just see that in and out. There are teams with any kind of perimeter big that, you know, if Toppin goes inside, you've got, over the course of 82 games, there can be a lot of points generated.
Just one more thing on Toppin too, because you kind of talked about potential fits for him. I know there's a few Golden State Warriors fans that kind of listen and have opinions on, you know, whether Toppin might be a potential fit. Wouldn't it work? I mean, I don't know. I was thinking about this. One of the biggest things from last year during the finals, and I know he was injured, but sometimes, honestly, it does feel like Obi Toppin moves like he's injured defensively occasionally. DeMarcus Cousins was virtually unplayable. He got screened to death, pick and rolled to death in last year's NBA finals. Wouldn't that worry you as a Warriors fan, you know, kind of bringing in someone who has that same risk to your team and making the finals run that next year? Like, I feel like that's just a fit that should be completely avoided.
Yeah. To my understanding, there have been reports and kind of discussions that the Warriors have discussed that with Toppin. I doubt it happens. And, you know, pretty much for the exact reasons you said, I just don't know if I see the fit there for 82 or 16 games. I think if they wanted to take a big, you go Okongwu or Wiseman. I don't think based on my intel that they should worry too much to the Warriors fans out there that listen to this. But you pretty much hit it right on the head of kind of the reasons to stay away.
Yeah. So we have four more guys to get through, so we're going to just kind of speed this up. But Isaiah Stewart, higher or lower?
Higher on both ends.
Higher on both ends. He's someone I think both Alex and I have risen on recently. And for good reason.
Yeah, he's worked his way into my top 30 just moving forward, just kind of for the same reasons that I'm raising Toppin up a bit. But I'd love to hear your opinion, because I know you're very familiar with him and his game.
If you buy him long-term, you buy his shooting. I don't think he'll be elite. I think he'll be able to stretch a decent amount. I think he'll be able to hit just enough threes to kind of keep the defense honest. And keep them from just completely standing alone and watching him on the perimeter. He's a bruiser. He's going to beat the crap out of you all game, every game. And that is where, even though he's not a guy that – I think draft Twitter a lot of times, if a guy can't win you the game on his shoulders, then they just don't want you. And that's not Stuart. You're never going to ask him to do that. But a dog in the paint, and just an absolute brute physically, you know, he's just going to fight the whole time. He's going to wear you out. He's going to wear you down. He's going to get his rebounds. He'll guard the rim, or he'll protect the rim to an extent. You know, not a great vertical guy, so he's not going to fly above the rim to meet you and block you. But he'll be able to hold his own in the post. And if he is able to stretch a little bit on offense, then I think you've got a winner there. And he's had the best interviews far and away of any prospect in this class when he's talking to teams. Yeah, so teams love him. They love his character. They love his work ethic. They love everything about this kid. So he's the ultimate, I want this kid in my organization. And yeah. I think that's something that people who only watch film, I can understand why some are low. I totally get that. But there's more to him than basketball, and that's what makes him a winner for me.
So that's what I was just going to ask you, but you kind of answered it. Everything that I've heard, everything that, you know, has been around Isaiah Stuart is just extremely, extremely glowing about him off the court, in the locker room, even on the court, just his body language and maturity. And it sounds like you're hearing pretty much the exact same things, if not more.
Yeah, absolutely. People just love him. He's a likable guy. I wouldn't see him slipping way too far in this class.
Someone who's kind of on the potential opposite spectrum of that entire thing is Vernon Carey, but also someone who's pretty polarizing in terms of just big guys in this class. What are your thoughts on Carey?
So finally, I pretty much agree with Draft Twitter on this guy. So for any of the Maxi slander that y'all have hated, we can at least join together on Vernon Carey.
thank God.
Big kid. I think he'll be able to score inside on the interior. He's just not as great of an athlete as you'd like to see right now. And there's other intel stuff as well on him that would make me hesitate. So I think basketball-wise, you're getting an interior scorer. You're getting a good passer. Fairly good, a fairly quick decision maker down in the post, which is nice to see from a big man. But there's enough intel-wise that would make me stay away. So Stuart is a guy that even if one day you might be able to rely on him scoring off the block less than Carey, I would take Stuart way above him.
Yeah, I'm in that same boat. You know, every time I watched Carey, I never really got the vibe that I got from Stuart, you know, as far as body language he shows and, you know, potential intangibles. He just didn't seem like my kind of guy, the kind of guy I'd want in an organization.
One thing that cracks me up about Carey is I think it was the opening night. I can't remember if they played against Kansas or Michigan. I don't remember which team played who in that opening classic. But he stepped out and hit a three in the first half. And it was like, oh, man, if this Carey kid steps out and is a three-point shooter, like, it's a wrap. This kid's going to be so good, you know. And I bought into that. I was like, dude, this kid could be a problem. And then he hit eight all season. And I was like, okay, like, we never should have looked into that. Like, so did go 8 for 21 on the year, 38%, low volume. But, like, if you look at percentage, sure, maybe he can step out and stretch one day. He just wasn't asked to do much, so I'm not going to bank on that at the next level. But I look back, and that moment in that game was one of those where I look and laugh at myself of like, wow, you really almost hook, line, and sinkered this kid as a perimeter guy.
That happens, also, man.
There's also that thing, that I don't know if you guys have seen it, floating around recently. It was about 2 years ago when Carey was explaining his college decision to go to Duke, and he cited as one of the things saying that, you know, Coach K was going to use him as someone who's a pick-and-roll ball handler, bringing the ball up occasionally, and that just did not happen whatsoever. Right. So certainly interesting. I don't buy that for anyone listening as part of his upside is as a ball handling five. I just don't see that.
No, not at all.
Two more guys to get through though, and they're near the top of pretty much every single mock, every single big board that you'll see. But maybe Alex might have Anthony Edwards near Mason Jones by the time October comes. But first, Ant-Man, Anthony Edwards. Thoughts on Anthony Edwards?
I agree with media and Twitter on Edwards. I think he's the best shot creator in the class. Phenomenal athlete. Can fall asleep, quite frankly, on both ends of the floor at times. Decision-making on both ends can be an issue. But, I mean, one-step vertical athlete that not many people in this class compare to. So I'm kind of all in on Edwards. What he turns into at the next level, I don't know. But his ability to get his own shot, create his own shot, inside, outside, soar above the rim, like, he's got everything you want on offense. So I'm willing to bet on him, comfortably top five, and he should go there accordingly.
And then last guy here, LaMelo Ball.
Ball, currently, you know, Hayes was my number one for a long, long time. I have Ball there now. I just, at his size, the vision and ease with which he makes some of these difficult passes, like, you just can't look past that. I mean, he is really, really good. And if he becomes one of those guys that's, give me a league average 3-point shooter, you know, off the catch, off the dribble, I mean, you've got a stud. You've got an absolute monster. I think if he continues to develop physically as well, you know, his lower body is an issue a little bit. Sometimes you look like, wow, like maybe you shouldn't bend that way when you're driving. But he's number one for me. And I think if you're looking for a creator at the next level, like you take LaMelo for sure.
Agree with you there. That's been our long-lasting central theme on the Prospect Podcast is LaMelo versus Killian.
I'm dying on the Killian hill.
Glad that Derek joins forces here on the Prospect Podcast and makes the vote 2-1 for the time being. So we have more guests. Okay.
I'm in the minority.
I want to put it out there, too, for Ball. There's still a group out there that would stay away from him because of his family.
That's ridiculous.
I think it's wrong. Like, have there been issues with the way that things have been handled in the past? Yes. But to pass on him or hold against him and what he can be as a basketball player because of somebody else, I think that would be a poor choice. And I think that's in poor taste. So I would just
agree
there. LaMelo Ball doesn't need anything from me because I am a nobody. But I just want to make sure that for the people out there who are still a little negative on him, like there's no reason to not be in his corner right now. So I just kind of want to say that.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up too, because and like honestly, like how much have we seen LaVar in the media recently? I know he's got his fair share of bans and stuff like that, but he has not been the voice that he was when Lonzo or when these guys were in high school. It's not the same anymore. And I'm sorry that you can shame LaVar all you want for being a supportive father, but he's not going to affect LaMelo Ball's career track. He hasn't affected Lonzo Ball's career track in any way either. If anything, he's helped them. So I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something that really ticks me off when I hear people knocking Ball for, I don't want to draft LaMelo because LaVar is going to be in the picture. Like, no, that's not something that would happen. No.
Right.
Yeah. Bad taste, not a fan. Doesn't relate.
And this was definitely a marathon of an episode. Thank you, Derek, for staying on here. Some great conversations that we've dove into. Last thing I want to get from you, and this is just going to be from you, but this is a really deep draft. This is a draft that, you know, it doesn't move much between spots, say 40 to 90, 40 to 100, whatever. Can you give me maybe three sleepers that you're looking at? Guys that could make a potential impact on an NBA roster next season.
Yeah. So I got three guys, just from the questions earlier, because I wrote them out. I got three guys in round two and three undrafted that I like. Actually, I put a fourth one there as parentheses. So round two, I think Malachi Flynn is awesome. I tweeted a couple weeks ago, just a simple statement. Malachi Flynn is dope, and I stand by that. I think he's going to be really good. Tyshawn Alexander is a guy that, you know, a lot of people kind of sleeping on a little bit. Draft Twitter's coming around on him. Versatile both on both ends. 39.9% from three. I really wish he would have hit one more so I can call him a 40% three-point shooter. But was trusted to take big shots for his team. Was good in the ball with the ball in his hands. Efficient in the pick and roll. And was often tasked with defending the opposing team's best player. I think he's just a dog. He's a fighter. And he's a guy I want on my team in that second round. And then Jay Scrubb is a guy to really watch out for. Slept on to an extent because he was a JUCO player at John Logan Community College. A lot of people are coming around on him, you know, had some decent workouts. I was able to see a little bit of his film from the USA camp against guys, you know, his own age and whatnot, and just dominated parts of that. And he is just a phenomenal athlete. And he's not only a good athlete on camera because he was going up against JUCO guys. Like, in his own right, he's an amazing athlete. So I think Jay Scrubb is a round two guy to look at and worth taking a flyer on. Undrafted free agents, if they were to go undrafted, Mamadi Diakite is a guy that to keep an eye on from Virginia. I think he can be a very good role player for somebody for a couple years. Corey Kispert from Gonzaga, 6'7", shoot the lights out. Decent passer as well, comfortable pick and roll. I think he's one to keep an eye on. Nathan Knight from William & Mary. one of my favorites. I saw him come down to OU at the beginning of the year and just dominate. And maybe this – I'm a little biased because I saw it in person. I mean, 6'10", calling for a ball, and it's just like, give me the ball at the top of the key. I was like, whoa, what is this guy doing? Like, what is he doing out here?
Grab a rebound and take it coast to coast. It's ridiculous. Man,
he can handle the ball. Like, I'm not going to say he's a point guard, but it's like for a big dude, he can handle the ball and can get to the rim. Like, it's pretty crafty. And I really liked watching him play. So Nathan Knight's one that I'd take a shot on. And the last guy I wrote down, because depending on what he decides to do, was written off so hard and so fast by some. But there's enough there for a team to bet on. And it wouldn't shock me if he went in round two, but also a quick undrafted pick is Khalil Whitney.
Yeah, it's interesting. And
it is. It's a guy who's just like completely fallen off the radar to some. There's a reason he was a big-time recruit. It fell apart at Kentucky. I understand why people wrote him off. And this is not me saying, hey, I'd give him a contract. But it's like there's enough there to where if he goes undrafted, you go, you know what, I'll bring him on my G-League team. I'll put him on my G-League team. And maybe you come out looking like a genius. So I think Whitney's the name to at least follow.
Yeah, definitely. I'm with you there.
100%. Yeah, he's just – he's. I mean, like you said, he's fallen off the face of the earth since he left Kentucky or what, you know, whatever went down there. I mean, it's, it was tough for him, and he wasn't having that great of a season beforehand either. But he's still a five-star recruit, was one of the best in his class going into the season. Like you said, there is enough there to at least give him a chance in some capacity at some level, wherever it may be. He's still extremely young too. So. But that just about wraps it up. Derek, thank you so much for joining us for your time today.
Thanks, man.
You can see just an extremely smart mind. Read Derek's scouting reports that he puts out. Follow him on Twitter at DMurrayNBA. He's the first of many talented guests that we're going to hope to have on the Prospect Podcast in the coming weeks. So, Derek, again, just thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, no problem at all. There's no two other guys that I would – happily find a empty hotel lobby business office and record a podcast in while I'm out of town. So I appreciate you guys having me on.
Hey, thanks, man. Always great talking to you.
Extremely flattering. So make sure you follow Derek, as I said, at DMurrayNBA on Twitter. Follow me at Ethan Piotta. Follow Alex at AHB Analytics. And follow the Prospect Pod. Lastly, since you're just following everyone anyway, at Prospect Pod. Support us. Like, leave reviews. Really appreciate it. Love the traction that we've been getting. This is our 9th episode. Hoping to, you know, just continue the one week episode thing that we've got going on. But that's all we have here, and we'll be back next week.